Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of redefinedonline.org, covering the stories behind the new definition of public education. On this episode, Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill talks with author and education policy expert Natalie Wexler. Her new book is The Knowledge Gap, The Hidden Cause of America's Broken Education System and How to Fix It. The two discuss what Wexler believes are the core ideas to narrowing the academic gap that have been overlooked by modern education systems as well as reformers, immersing children from less educated families in knowledge about the world and linking that knowledge to their writing and reading instruction. Thank you for listening and enjoy the episode.
So today I'm excited to have Natalie Wexler, who is an education journalist and has a new book out, The Knowledge Gap, The Hidden Cost of America's Broken Education System and How to Fix It. Welcome, Natalie.
Thank you, Doug. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm happy to have you. So let's talk a little about what's broken. We'll start there and then we'll talk about how to fix it. So what's broken?
What's broken? Okay. Well, I mean, there are actually a number of things, of course, that are broken in our education system. But when people look at the inequities in our education system, they're liable to point to things like inferior resources in certain schools or less effective teachers or low expectations, all sorts of things. And, you know, not to say that those things are unimportant, but what they all overlook is that our standard approach to teaching, and particularly to teaching reading, really only works to the extent that it does work for kids who start out with advantages for the most part. And for the others, you know, what happens is that the inequities that they bring with them into the school just get magnified, and they fall farther and farther behind over the course of their schooling. And when I say reading, I'm particularly talking about how we teach reading comprehension. And there's also a lot of problems with the way we teach reading words, sounding them out, but basically spend a lot of time, especially in elementary school, on having kids do things like practice finding the main idea or make inferences. And the theory is that it doesn't really matter that much what they're reading, and the goal is not for them to acquire any particular knowledge, but that if they get really good at finding the main idea, they will be able to apply that skill to any text that's put in front of them and become better all-around readers. And the problem with that is that as cognitive scientists have known for a long time, the most important factor really in reading comprehension is not generally applicable skill, it's how much you know about the topic. And so instead of doing what we've been doing, which is to marginalize subjects like social studies, the kinds of things that really could build kids' academic knowledge and vocabulary, we should be immersing all kids in those knowledge-building subjects, and especially the kids who are least likely to pick up that kind of knowledge and vocabulary at home.
Why is knowledge so important with reading comprehension?
Well, I mean, it really has to do with what cognitive scientists call working memory, but which is kind of like short-term memory or consciousness. But basically, the idea is, generally, whatever you're learning, working memory can only hold a limited number of things for a limited period of time, has very limited capacity, just like a few seconds. And so the more things you're trying to think about in working memory, the more likely you are to become overwhelmed. So the more stuff you have stored in your long-term memory, and that includes knowledge of concepts, vocabulary, all sorts of things, how to decode words, the more things that you can just take out of your long-term memory without having to juggle them in working memory, the more cognitive capacity you have for things like thinking about the meaning of something or analyzing it. And so if, you know, I'm reading a passage about a topic I know well, let's say education policy, I'm going to have a much easier time understanding that and acquiring new information from that, because I don't have to juggle. I don't have to think, oh, gee, what does No Child Left Behind mean, right? But if I'm reading about quantum mechanics or molecular biology and I have no knowledge of those things, it's going to be much harder for me, because I'm going to have to think, what does that mean? And I might have to look stuff up, and that breaks my train of thought, and I might get the wrong definition. I might not understand the definition. And you know, so I think it's pretty much common sense to some extent you know, if you think about trying to read about something that you just don't know much about. But I think what is less obvious, two things are less obvious. One is, even when we're reading a regular old newspaper article, or, you know, listening to even on the radio to a news report or whatever, we are using our background knowledge all the time, unconsciously, to make sense of what we're reading or hearing. And I think the other thing that is not so obvious is how much some kids don't know about the world, how much vocabulary they're missing through no fault of their own. And so, you know, a third grade passage on our third grade reading test might look pretty straightforward and simple to an educated adult, but to a lot of third graders, it's going to be as impenetrable as a scholarly article about molecular biology would be to me.
Kids come to school with radically different backgrounds in terms of knowledge. The teachers don't fully appreciate the impact of that difference on reading. And so they're working on skill development and not appreciating that lack of background knowledge is having a huge impact on comprehension.
That's basically it. I mean, they do understand that, you know, and this is not to blame teachers. I mean, I think this is a very complicated phenomenon. It's a whole system, and it has to do with their training and the materials they get. But there is an acknowledgement. Nobody challenges the idea that background knowledge is important in reading comprehension, but the strategies that that teachers tend to use are designed to activate prior knowledge. And there's really no accounting for what happens if you don't have any relevant prior knowledge to activate.
So talk to me about how you would see schools operating differently if we were much more attuned to the importance of background knowledge as it relates to reading comprehension. And I also want to talk about writing in a minute, but sort of paint a picture for our listeners about how the school might look different than it does today.
The most effective way to build kids' knowledge is through a coherent curriculum that is focused on content and that extends across grade levels. Now, that's not to say that individual teachers are powerless to build kids' knowledge, but knowledge building is a gradual cumulative process that extends across years. I mean, if you are going to learn about the Civil War, it really helps to know something about what happened before the Civil War. And it's an individual teacher has no control over what happens the previous year or the following year. So the only way to ensure that kind of logical knowledge is to have the school or the district or a charter network or somebody adopt a content-focused curriculum. And there are now, I have certainly seen schools that are doing this, and that, you know, even teachers who were skeptics, I've talked to a number of them, who have really been won over by the engagement they see on the part of their students, even when they thought, as one teacher said to me, my third graders aren't going to be interested in learning about ancient Rome or the Vikings. That's going to be too difficult for them. And lo and behold, they couldn't get enough of it. And she, to bring in writing for a minute, this particular teacher said the other thing that convinced her was the sudden improvement in her students' writing, because suddenly they had something to write about. They had something to say.
The criticism you hear a lot that the curriculum has been narrowed so much to focus on the test, and inadvertently, perhaps we undermined our reading instruction because we thought that skill development would drive test scores, when in fact it might have done the opposite. Do you think that's something that happened?
I do. I mean, I think there is some disagreement. It's very hard to really know what is going on in American classrooms. We don't have a lot of good data. And there are those who say social studies has always been marginalized. Back in the 90s, people were complaining that there wasn't enough time spent on social studies. But certainly from the teachers I've talked to, and there is definitely some data to show this, that since testing, high stakes testing came in essentially in 2002 with No Child Left Behind, the amount of time and attention on things other than reading and math has really decreased. Now, I do want to say I'm not against testing per se. Testing uncovered a lot of inequities in the system that were previously hidden. You know, an A at one school is not going to be equivalent to an A at another, and this was a way of showing that up. But tests were never meant to be a guide to instruction. And it's clear to me from speaking to teachers and from being in classrooms that that's what they have inadvertently become. And it's, you can understand it. I mean, teachers look at these tests, the tests are not, the reading tests I'm talking about, they're not tied to any particular body of knowledge. And so they look like they're testing skills, reading comprehension skills. In fact, they try to avoid any particular knowledge kids might learn in school because they don't want to test that. You know, the theories were testing skills. And of course, if you don't have the particular knowledge required to understand the passage, you don't get an opportunity to demonstrate your skills. But it's very hard sometimes for teachers to take that in, especially when there's so much pressure, both at the school level and sometimes at the individual level, when their evaluations are linked to test scores, there's so much pressure to raise those test scores. And as one, I think she was a fourth grade teacher here in DC, said to me, you know, she was supposed to be teaching social studies as well as English language arts, but she said, well, there's no consequences attached to the so knowing or not knowing the social studies material. I mean, there's not going to be a question on the test about where the Navajo resided or what sedimentary rock is. And what my kids are going to need are their skills. So that's what I focus on.
I used to love to teach writing because for me, it was a way to teach thinking. And also lots of fascinating conversations about knowledge and knowledge claims. So talk about how you see the writing instruction today and how you think it ought to be done as it ties to this whole concept of a knowledge-rich curriculum.
Well, yeah, writing, you know, has been really neglected, has not gotten nearly the attention that reading has gotten, and yet it is really far more difficult for kids to learn to do. It's expressive rather than receptive. So it's like there's between speaking a foreign language and understanding a foreign language, it's a lot harder to speak. So it's a lot harder to write than it is to read. I will say that many reasons to teach writing. One is that it's not just background knowledge that helps you understand what you read. It's also familiarity with the conventions of written language, which, so you could be an expert on baseball, but you know, and there's this famous baseball study that showed if you know more about baseball, it doesn't really matter how you scored on a standardized reading test, you're probably going to be better at understanding a description of a baseball game. But that doesn't mean you'd be better able to understand, say, a scholarly article about baseball. If it was using a lot of vocabulary you're not familiar with or syntax that you're not familiar with, longer sentences, the passive voice. So all of those things are part of reading comprehension. And the best way to teach, to get kids familiar with that peculiar syntax and vocabulary of written language is to get them to use it in their own writing. And then, you know, they learn how to use a word like moreover or despite, and if they can counter it in their reading, they're going to be much better able to understand it. So that's one important reason to teach writing. Another important reason to teach writing is that, as you mentioned, it's related to thinking. It's totally related to knowledge. I mean, it's hard to read about something you don't know about. It's virtually impossible to write about something you don't know about, right? So there's this kind of two-way connection between knowledge and writing. And it's pretty obvious before you can write about something, you need to know something about it. But the thing that's less obvious is that in the process of writing, you really gain a lot of, you deepen your knowledge. You have to make connections. You have to figure out what's important. All of these things that we actually try to teach through these reading comprehension strategies, like finding the main idea, comparing and contrasting, writing forces you to do that in a very rigorous way, much more so than reading. There is, however, a very important caveat, which is, as I said, writing is really, really hard. And this goes back to working memory. I mean, reading imposes a huge burden on working memory, but writing imposes an even bigger one. So if we ask inexperienced writers to write at length, especially, that can be so overwhelming that they neither learn to write well, nor do they get these knowledge-boosting benefits from writing. But that's what we do. We basically ask even kindergartners to write at length, you know, because we want them to develop their voice or their fluency. And the problem is that, you know, they probably won't be able to do those things unless they first learn how to write beginning at the sentence level.
Right.
And we have not paid much attention to teaching And this is not just for young kids. I mean, there are many high school students who have not learned to write good sentences, and we just assume they'll pick it up if they read enough, and many, many of them don't. They really need explicit instruction.
I can tell you, as a former high school teacher who taught philosophy, so there's a lot of writing. But I think that one of the challenges is it takes a long time to score a paper and to give feedback, and so I'm sure a lot of teachers, I mean, fortunately I was single when I first started teaching, but I would spend probably 10 or 12 hours on a weekend grading a set of papers. I thought it was a great way to teach, but it was tremendously time consuming.
Yes.
You know, it's a very intimate way to teach, by the way, because you really connect with a child's mind over a period of time as they write and you give feedback and goes back. Well, you've had editors, so you know exactly that process.
And it's, it can be really absorbing and fascinating, but incredibly time consuming. And so this is, so I don't know if you, I don't think you mentioned this, that the other book that I have co-authored, I mean, I wrote The Knowledge Gap, a couple of years before that came out, I co-authored a book called The Writing Revolution with a veteran educator named Judith Hochman, who she developed really through trial and error over many years, this method of teaching writing that turns out to correspond very well to what cognitive science has found about how the brain works and how writing works. And so one of the things that method does is it does two things that I have not seen in any other method. One is that it grounds all writing activities and instruction in the content of the curriculum. So not what was your trip to the amusement park like last weekend, and not should we have chocolate milk in the cafeteria, but you're learning about the Civil War or whatever, then let's write about the Civil War because you're going to build knowledge. You're going to build the knowledge that's important. But secondly, it begins at the sentence level, no matter what grade kids are in, and this is designed to be used at all grade levels and across all subjects. But one of the advantages of beginning writing instruction at the sentence level is that it does make it much easier to deal with those mistakes, or, you know, both conceptual mistakes and grammatical or usage errors. And so if you start there, then by the time your students are writing essays, you really should not have to deal with, so you won't have to spend that much time, and the student will not get a paper covered with red ink, which of course can be very discouraging.
Step Up, which manages this blog, is the largest education choice organization in the country. We're all about customization. Some people use the term personalization. I know you're a person who also supports education choice, but there's also some caveats that you're concerned about. So talk a little bit about the danger of maybe going too far in the direction of too much individualization, too much customization, and not enough sort of community sense of knowledge and sharing values and sharing shared understandings.
Yeah, the idea that customization or personalization is good is not limited to advocates of choice. There's a lot of that going on in the traditional public school system as well. And it is true that kids, you know, in one classroom are going to have a range of abilities and interests, perhaps. But our current system is really, especially at the elementary level, you've got kids reading at all different quote-unquote reading levels, which are largely illusory since, as we know, there is no such thing as a fixed reading level. It's going to depend on the topic and how much you know about it. But the kids who are less able readers are restricted to simpler books and different and simpler content. And the kids who are more able are able to read much more complex books, and they are also able to acquire, they get a better chance to acquire new information from those books, partly because there is more information in those books, but also because they're more likely to have some background knowledge relating to that new information and therefore better able to retain it. So we can't let customization or personalization determine the content that kids are going to be exposed to. You know, you may have a decoding problem. That doesn't mean you can't understand the same content as somebody who's a better decoder. It doesn't have to do with your intelligence. So one of the things about these curricula, and I did spend time in classrooms that were using various knowledge-building curricula, one of the things they have in common, although they're different in many ways, is they have the teacher, especially at lower grade levels, reading aloud to the entire class from not just one book on zebras and then one a book on clouds, but for, say, a couple of weeks, reading aloud from books or texts that are on the same topic and that are more complex than most of those kids could read on their own. And, you know, maybe those kids didn't choose that particular topic, but from what I've heard, they get very interested. If it's in, it may be something they know nothing about, they can't choose it. They get very interested in that topic and they want to know more about it. And so, you know, I think where the customization or differentiation or whatever you want to call it comes in is, like, how do those kids respond? First of all, what are they reading on their own? I mean, that's obviously gonna vary, but you may find if they've already taken in a lot of information by listening, they're gonna be able to read at a higher level than you would expect. But then when it comes to something like writing, you can, obviously you're gonna have some kids who are gonna be more able writers than others. So one kid writes a sentence, another writes a paragraph, a third writes an essay, but it's about the same content. So we're not, you know, balkanizing the classroom in a way and just having, you know, not only does that, it's really a form of tracking, you know, but it also, it really interferes with the sense of classroom community. Kids are very conscious of what right. reading group they're in.
One of your premises is that the knowledge gap is a huge contributor to inequity, and that's why we need to be more thoughtful about that and attentive. But, you know, a lot of classroom teachers are pretty intimidated by that. And what kind of advice would you give to a teacher who has a very diverse set of kids coming in with backgrounds? I mean, how do you address the equity issue in a way that is doable for a classroom teacher, given how much diversity that kids come into the classroom with?
Well, you know, I'm not a classroom teacher myself, but the ones I've spoken to have told me over and over again that it is the quote-unquote low achievers who flourish the most under this kind of content-focused knowledge-building approach, that they are the ones who may make the most insightful contributions to class discussion. They have told me, you know, all of their kids are interested, engaged, and they're all, you know, thriving. But what's really striking is the equity piece. For example, there was this teacher I wrote a profile of. She had what was mostly a pretty, you know, kids from a pretty wealthy demographic. But there were some kids who did, you know, came from lower socioeconomic status. And there was one girl in particular who, you know, had been diagnosed with dyslexia, had an IEP. It was really not, you know, was struggling. This was in third grade. And yet, she was the one who remembered certain vocabulary words months later. She was the one who made these contributions to class discussion, which, of course, you know, I mean, not only is that allowing her to fulfill more of her potential, but it's, what is that doing for her self-esteem? In fact, she made some incredible gain on a reading comprehension test in just a few months, which I think must have had partly to do with increased self-confidence. And, you know, her classmates now have a different view of her, and the teacher has higher expectations of that kid. So, yeah, I mean, I'm not saying, you know, there are never going to be challenges. And certainly if you have kids who are still learning English, you know, that can be a challenge. But they're not going to do better in an approach that puts skills and strategies in the foreground. They're probably going to do worse. They'll still need maybe extra supports, but they need to have a chance to gain access to the same knowledge that their classmates are.